This is Mentor, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps. Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. In this episode, we're covering mixed depression and anxiety. Whilst these are separate conditions, they often exist simultaneously. People often get what's known as a dual diagnosis, like our guest for this week's episode. So from Mind, we found that in 2016, Mind reported 7.8 out of every 100 people experience mixed anxiety and depression. So really that's 7.8% is how I would have phrased it if I were them. But I think that's a good start to demonstrate how common this is. I don't think people, including myself, realize before knowing stats like this, how common it is for people to simultaneously have both conditions and how, as our guest describes, that makes things even more complicated. There can already be so many variables when you have one condition, but when you have two, they can present in so many different ways. They can influence each other a lot as well. And so I've got some background research on the combination of depression and anxiety as well. And this is from verywellmind.com. So they said on their website, symptoms of depression and anxiety often co-occur in certain disorders. In fact, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, major depression often accompanies panic disorder and other anxiety disorders. While depression and anxiety have distinct clinical features, there is some overlap of symptoms. For example, in both depression and anxiety, irritability, decreased concentration, and impaired sleep are common. So that's a good way of describing how there is that overlap, but also they can make each other worse. It's a really important topic, I feel, to get this kind of combination covered. It's quite universal how different mental health conditions can influence each other. We'll get into that interview in just a moment with Claire Jeffrey, but first,
this week's Audible recommendation.
I'm recommending The Good Immigrant. I feel like this book is particularly relevant in our current political climate, and I'll read directly from the description to give you a sense of what it's all about. Bringing together 21 exciting minority ethnic voices emerging in Britain today, The Good Immigrant explores why immigrants come to the UK, why they stay, and what it means to be other in a country that may not necessarily want you or truly accept you, however many generations you've been here. So in the book, I think it's brilliant how it's got all these different people, many of which you may have already be aware of who they are. And basically it's them telling their story. The audiobook, they even narrate their own segments of it, which I think is really magic. And as always, you can get it for free as your first audiobook with Audible. You just need to follow our link, bit.ly/mentalbooks. The details are in the description.
So my name's Claire Jeffrey. I was diagnosed about 9 years ago with depression and anxiety. Around the time I had just moved from London to New Zealand to study, and I was experiencing kind of homesickness and, you know, at 18, moving home and moving as far away from home, kind of what I expected to be normal, using inverted commas. But I was finding that I wasn't quite settling and kind of fitting in. And I thought it was just a little bit more than homesickness. Like, I felt it was kind of more like something a bit deeper than that.
So at the time, were you aware of the possibility of it being mental illness?
I had heard of mental illness, and in terms of like your schizophrenia and bipolar type conditions, OCDs, that may be a little bit more outward facing than kind of your inward facing kind of depression, anxiety type conditions. I didn't know if that's what it was. Like, I don't know I didn't go in and know, one, that there was something wrong, like something wasn't quite right, or two, that it was going to be something mental health. I was getting a couple of like kidney infections that I thought were sort of like stress from studying and being away. I am a little bit of a perfectionist. I'm my own worst critic, and I do expect really high standards of myself, which does put pressure on me in terms of my work and things like that. Like, I was having a lot of more physical manifestations. And so I went to see my GP, and they were pretty much like, yeah, it's homesickness.
And this is while you're away in New Zealand.
Yeah. So this is when I was away. So I went to see my GP over there, like at kind of the student health. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I still wasn't like 100%. Like, I still didn't feel that this was just a homesickness thing and it would just go away. So I went to see my GP again and kind of discussed it more in terms of what my stresses were, kind of what, like, how I was sleeping, how I was eating, kind of my day-to-day impact. And that's when I was diagnosed. So it wasn't, it was kind of more actually just going in depth to what is in your daily life, what's really going on. And that's kind of where it came from. It wasn't dismissed. She actually listened to me. And we kind of discussed it. I think it might be this is what we could do for you. It was kind of like a mutual thing. So it was quite nice. It didn't seem scary or unknown. Like, it was kind of like, yeah, this could make sense. And there's a plan forward. So, yeah, it kind of filled me a little bit more with confidence.
Right, and that was when you were back in the UK?
Yes, that was when I was back in the UK. When I came back to the UK, I kind of felt like everything should be back to normal. Mm-hmm. I've been away for 3 years. I hadn't seen my family. My grandfather passed away while I was away, so I never got to see him and kind of say goodbye and kind of have that closure with him. I missed my sister's 18th birthday. Like, I missed quite a few family things. And I thought, well, now I'm back with my family, everything should be normal. And I did feel selfish for not being kind of the bright and bubbly, everything's perfect kind of person now that I'm surrounded with my family. And yeah, I'm back in London, everything's like so much going on. It really, I did feel quite selfish. That I was feeling this way, kind of guilty that you know, I shouldn't be unhappy. I should have a lot to celebrate and be grateful for. And I think that's what a lot of people do, is especially nowadays, is they compare themselves to others, and it's like, well, you know, I'm healthy and everything else, you know, what right do I have to complain? But it's not as simple and straightforward as that. So
yes, well, it seems increasingly so in this really globalized world, it's easy to see examples of people that are better and worse off.
Exactly.
And pitch yourself against them, but actually you're all going through your own life.
Yeah.
And it's not comparable, because you're not living their life, they're not living yours.
No, no one's going to post the, you know, bad hair days and, you know, the fact that they've got like those spots that have come up. They're all going to post the perfect things to kind of reinforce this perfect life. So yeah,
and that's why what you've described there is quite a common experience with anxiety as well, this kind of comparing and this guilt that people can feel about perfectly valid feeling.
Exactly. So that's when I kind of felt that, you know, I need to go and speak to someone. And that's when I saw my GP and kind of we sat down and had a talk and sort of went from there, really.
And so how did that affect you, being told that it was two conditions?
I think in terms of two conditions, it is quite difficult. I kind of think of them as two devils on my shoulders. And it's not that they're negative things, but I have the depression that really struggles with kind of motivation and just feeling positive about myself. And I have the anxiety, which is, well, you're going to let everyone down, people are depending on you, and they really do fight against each other. And I think that's with a dual diagnosis. If you have one diagnosis, you can kind of focus all your energy on that. But I feel that mine are kind of opposite ends of the spectrum. So it's so difficult to just try and get a balance right in the middle, and that you're not tipping one, not focusing one more energy on one diagnosis than the other, that you're kind of splitting them both, which can be really exhausting. But any day where you're not taking a step backwards is progress. So just maintaining that balance, no matter how exhausting, is still a positive step. So it's just kind of seeing those really small things and really just believing that you can keep doing it and keep achieving those.
Absolutely. And in terms of then to finish up talking about that GP experience, so following diagnosis, what was the action plan? What did they say should happen there?
So we talked about medication, which I think commonly is one of the first things that GPs do talk about. But I didn't want that to be my first option. I was prepared to take medication and long-term if needed, but I wanted to explore more therapies first. So we set up a plan to do counselling and also to do cognitive behavioural therapy as well. So we had kind of the talking about your feelings and kind of what you think might be the triggers related to what's going on, also doing the CBT in terms of relaxation techniques and kind of breathing, to so that when I was getting into a state where I was feeling low or anxious, I could try and just pull myself back to sort of gain kind of a little bit more control. So that was kind of the first plan, was counselling and CBT.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so with the medication, you were on that for a little while?
I tried two different medications. I couldn't get on with either of them with the side effects. So one of them, I was experiencing quite significant weight gain. I literally could not stop eating, which then doesn't help with your kind of feeling of self-confidence, self-esteem. Uh-huh. And then I switched to another medication that was giving me quite significant like leg tremors. So I'd be lying down and my legs would just be like shaking. So I really struggled with sleeping and stuff. So I tried both of those probably for about 4 to 6 weeks for each. I just couldn't cope with the side effects. So then I stopped the medication, sort of carried on with kind of counselling and CBT, which kind of maintained everything. And then last year was when I found that I needed more support. I was trying to just do it all by myself and I was just sinking, really. So that's when I went and spoke to my GP again and I explained the previous side effects I'd had with medication and we looked at another one. So it's been a year now that I'm on the right medication. Mm-hmm. We had to tweak it a little bit, but I'm now kind of managing really well and have restarted cognitive behavioral therapy online.
Okay.
Which is really helping. And I feel so much happier because I know that I've seen progress and it's just reflecting on what I've done to go, okay, well, baby steps, one little thing, even if it takes 6 months or a year, it's still, compared to where you were, it's still a step in the right direction. That to me has been kind of the biggest thing, is just not being such a perfectionist, not being so impatient, and just letting it happen.
Yeah, because, and actually, I think it's important to mention that sometimes being stable is progress. You know, sometimes the fact that you're not getting worse is progression. And I think particularly when you've got depression and anxiety, which is so common, people have that combination. One can trigger the other, or one can make the other worse.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I say, because with anxiety and depression, they kind of swing. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you feel just nothing. You feel with depression, you can't feel anything. It's like all your senses are just gone. But then with anxiety, it's like you feel so much. There's so much worry and there's so much panic. but then you have a middle as well. So it's really difficult having these two conditions because at the same time, they're similar, but they're so different. So I think just having this time now where I say I haven't got any worse, I feel every day just that tiny little fraction better is so like a massive progress.
Yeah, that's really brilliant to hear. And so just, I'm interested in terms of your experience then with uni, because it's really common that people first come across like the need to focus on their mental health when they're at university. I think this, it may be partly homesickness. It may be partly just the fact that you're on your own for the first time in many people's lives and you've got to look after you. And that's a completely different experience. And so when you'd come back to visit family in the UK, you'd had these diagnoses, did you then go back to uni or what happened then?
Yeah, I went back to university. So I completed my degree in New Zealand. So I did my 3 years of study all out there in one go. And then I did my postgraduate study here.
Okay.
And I think you're right in terms of you're 18, 19, your inner voice is developing. And that's the things that kind of how you think and the cycles you have, you're given that space to kind of grow and breathe. So you are thinking more about what's going on in your head.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why it becomes so common. And then you have homesickness and stress of, you know, exams or just how on earth am I meant to cook anything that's edible and where am I going to get money for, you know, living. I think you just all of a sudden you have like this huge wave of responsibilities at the same time that you're finding yourself. So I think that what would be great is if kind of when you're like 16, 17, it's just sort of kind of just gently preparing, and then it's not this huge influx of things that you have like a little bit of a kind of breaking in phase, which is, I know that when I have kids, that's what I'll be doing as best I can, is sort of kind of integrating them more and more and giving them more freedom towards this time, so that when it comes 18 and they fly the nest, that it's not such a horrendous or daunting or scary time.
Yeah, I think that's a really great approach, because I feel like with education, it can so often be neglected, the like social skills you learn and things like that. So like I have dyslexia, and so I sort of knew from quite early on I was never going to really excel at the academics. But mm-hmm. I feel I learned far more from school in terms of socializing and making friends and all the like extracurricular stuff than I probably got out of the classes. You know, there's things like maths class where there kind of came a point where I realized this stuff is no just longer hard. Relevant to day-to-day life for me.
I think, I mean, there were so many classes I did at school that I think in my day-to-day life now, they're not relevant. Whereas how you communicate and how you treat others is so important, and there should be kind of a more focus on, I don't want to call them soft skills because it makes me sound really corporate-y, but sort of around those, you know, just actual people skills.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's some basic things that I think are missing, like how I never was taught how to do an interview. Like, supposedly school is preparing you for the workplace, yet no one covered interviews, and you don't get the job without the interview.
No, and I say there's so much, like, even just pensions. Like, I go to so many meetings about pensions now. I'm like, I really don't get this. It's crazy. And I think, as well, just how to treat yourself. I think with school and going to university, like I can, my cousins are at that age now, and
one of my cousins was told, well, you're not going to pass this exam, so you're not going to take it. Mm-hmm. That's not anyone's right but his to make that decision because of grades. They're like, okay, well, if you take it and you fail, it'll reflect badly on the school. So we're just not going to let you take it anyway.
Wow.
That sort of thing is just not fair. It's like, we need to prepare people to fail and to learn and to grow from it.
Yeah, because you don't get that bubble wrap in the real world.
No, unfortunately, the amount of job rejections and interview rejections I've had, you need to be prepared for these sort of things because then you don't want to be going into a new job and going, well, you know, I didn't get the last three interviews, I'm not good enough, and having that imposter syndrome in your head already that you're not going to be good enough because it just reinforces that negative thoughts. Whereas you need to be thinking, okay, well, you know, this is my opportunity, I'm going to make a difference, I'm going to choose my path and my way of going and doing things. Anything that we can just kind of prepare kids, they sound really old, prepare younger people for actually what the real life is great.
Yeah. So out of interest, as we're talking about schools, we're running a campaign and a petition at the moment to get mental health education onto the school curriculum.
Yeah.
At the moment, it is in optional PSHE modules that most schools have access to, but it's not mandatory. Do you think that may have changed your awareness of mental health and maybe you would have known more earlier?
I think so. I did psychology at A-level, which gave me a kind of an insight into mental health in a very touched upon way, like a little dabble into abnormal psychology. But it wasn't a focus. And I think if we'd had, I mean, I can't even remember half of my PSHE classes because it was normally just a DOS lesson. If I had something.
I just love that you've made that point because that's what I say to anyone that says, where are they going to fit it in? The amount of times I watched a movie in PSHE.
I say, I can't remember anything in there that is actually usable today.
I think for me, the sex ed was the most important thing I probably learned in it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I went to an all-girls school and the sex education was really just not, what's the right word? It was a laugh. It was farcical. Whereas it should be taken. These are the things that actually, like, you know, 16, 17, it's like you really need to be just aware of what's going on with your bodies. And that's not just puberty and sexually, but it's in your head as well. It's mentally and emotionally how you cope with, you know, I broke up with my first boyfriend at 16 and I, like, I'm never going to love again. And, you know, it was like the biggest drama of my life, which is ridiculous.
No, but it's true, though, because at that age, that's what you're focused on. You're not focused on maths class as much as maths is useful to some people.
Yes, not as great to me, but yeah, no, but that's the thing. I think it's just making, like, now as well, I think so much could be done in terms of, like, social media and being just, like, a little bit aware online. Because I think you kind of, it gets tailored for quite young kids, like on chat rooms, don't talk to strangers, blah, 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 blah. But I think at that kind of the 11 to 17, 18, there's kind of a void that they're just kind of left to their own things. And yeah, I just think there just needs to be kind of a little thing, bit more constructive, both with mental health so much. There's so many people out there that are just really confused about what's going on with themselves, that just having that little bit of guidance, and it's not telling people what to do or what they think, but just acknowledging that their thoughts and feelings are real and they're valid.
Yeah, absolutely. And so to fast forward again then to where you are now with your mental health, how are you finding and understanding having a dual diagnosis at this point?
I understand it. I am still figuring it out in terms of I'm still trying to figure out what my triggers are. So knowing that if I do this, it's going to make me feel not great, or so kind of cutting down on my alcohol and stuff like that. I'm still trying to figure out what they are and kind of apply it to the workplace as well. So when I receive feedback, it's not a personal attack on me. It's constructive, and it's something I can work and learn from.
Yeah.
Because with, you know, negative feedback, low self-confidence, low self-esteem, back in the rut. So it's trying to really just see it from a different perspective. And trying to put myself into a new experience that is challenging enough to make me feel positive, mm-hmm. but not enough that if I don't achieve it or complete it, that I'll feel really rubbish about myself. So it's sort of finding the balance between everything.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. It actually reminds me of a statistic that I've used before on the show, but that mixed anxiety and depression has been... Sorry, I'm just going to re-record that. That actually reminds me of a statistic that I've used on the podcast before from mentalhealth.org.uk, that mixed anxiety and depression has been estimated to cause 1/5 of days lost from work in Britain.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised by that statistic. I think that with depression, it's kind of the whole, I can't get out of bed, like I just really just, I can't face the day.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with anxiety as well, it's then the worry, like I'm going to lose my job. So I will pull myself out of bed. I will get on the train, go to work. And I'll get to work and I just can't function because I'm so concerned with what's going on in my head. This relentless monologue of worry coincided with a physical feeling of just low mood and, you know, apathy, really, that I can totally relate of why that statistic would be there.
Yeah,
and it's a shame, like how much time is just lost, kind of from a business sense, but also from a people sense. Like, I know if I miss a day at work, then you know I don't get the gossip, and I don't catch up with my friends, and you know figure out what's happening on Love Island and the rest of it. So it's the social aspect of work as well.
You're the second guest to mention Love Island on this show, like that. It's really, everywhere.
I don't
yeah.
even watch it, but I know what's happening because we talk about it at work all the time.
That's so funny. But yeah, no, it's interesting though what you said about how they manifest in you, the two conditions, because from what I understand, that's one of the really tricky things about having depression and anxiety, because they can come out in each person differently.
Yep.
So for you, it sounds like the depression's trying to keep you home and the anxiety's making you feel you have to go in.
Yep.
Whereas for some people, the depression would keep them in and the anxiety would keep them away from work.
Yeah.
And, you know, so then they don't go. So it's different for each person.
I know. And that's what I talked to other friends that maybe just have one diagnosis, that it's really... One diagnosis can manifest in so many different ways. Put two into the mix and it is just, the variables are everywhere. So yeah, for me, my anxiety is very much a worry and kind of a fear of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas my depression is very much a no motivation, really low mood. And they are so conflicting.
Yeah.
That it is... Some days I'm exhausted just fighting the battle to try and find a middle. I feel like I'm just the opposite ends of the spectrum and just sort of try and get into the kind of middle, like I'm okay, like I can just sort of balance it out a little bit. It's draining. But, yeah,
the way you describe it, I'm sort of visualising them being like on either side of you, both kind of coming.
They are. It's almost like two devils on my shoulder. It's not like an angel and a devil, but it's like two devils on my shoulder are just sort of giving me this kind of advice, like, just stay at home today, like, it'll be fine. And the other one's going, well, if you stay at home, then, you know, that's how many sick days you've taken already this year, and they're going to start, like, concerning, you're still in your probation, and you might get fired. Like, what if you go to work, you're not going to do anything because you can't think because you're not very good at your job. And it is really, to me, that is like an everyday battle.
Yeah. And so now that you're getting more support with, like, the medication you're on and the uh-huh. counselling, what sort of tools are you finding particularly helpful for you?
So one of the tools that I am finding really helpful from cognitive behavioural therapy is, I didn't think I would find useful given what I've had, like, the kind of treatments I've had before. Mm-hmm. But it's, what advice would I give to a friend? So I started my new job on Monday, and I was sitting in the waiting room to go upstairs to my new office, and I was so nervous, so sick and worried. And it was worry like, you know, your colleagues aren't going to like you, you're not going to be good enough at your job, all of this sort of thing. And I just sat there and said, okay, if this was my friend here for her first day of job, her new job, what would you say to her? Like, okay, well, you know, you're a really lovely person. No one's meant to be perfect on the first day. Give yourself time and you're going to fit in. You're going to do great. And I just sat yeah. there and said that to myself. And I was like, huh, just felt a little bit lighter.
I think so, that's great. It's just a really straightforward technique to take you a bit out of that moment.
Exactly. It's just sort of seeing it from another perspective and just going, stop overthinking, over analysing everything, and just accept what's going to happen. I practice a lot of mindfulness as well, so it's like meditation and kind of relaxation techniques. So I think kind of those two things, as well as my medication, are really helping kind of me just stay where I am, just stabilise.
Yeah, that's really good. And so are there any other specific, like, maybe self-care things that you're finding really helpful?
I think just treating myself. So rather than using kind of negative reinforcement, so, you know, if you've had a really crappy day at work, I'll, you know, eat a bar of chocolate and it's like that sort of thing. But just treating myself to like a nice bubble bath or going and get my nails done or my hair done, just as like a little, I don't want to say reward because it's really not that, but just as a like, yeah, you're doing great, just keep mm-hmm. it up.
I think that's important. It's just like almost a like a visual, like, action cue of like yeah. raising your self-worth.
Yeah, and I think then I go to work and I'm like, oh, I got my nails done, do you like the colour? And it's just sort of another kind of social thing as well. Mm-hmm. Or people are like, oh, I really like your hair, like, it's like really funky, I never would have done it like that. Like, I had pink hair last year and I think that was just because I was having a really nightmare time. But yeah, just sort of just acknowledging what you're doing every day.
Yeah.
So just, you know, when you wake up and you're like, you know what, I can do this today. Like, it's, that's it, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, and that sounds really opposite to the perfectionism that you've described. I know.
And because of that, I am so hard on myself. It is just taking that step back and just going, do you know what, if it doesn't go 100% today, that's not a failure. Mm-hmm. It's completely okay. And I totally, as soon as I got diagnosed, I was just like, oh my God, how could you let this happen to myself? And it was really, it just hit me like a train, really, just the whole diagnosis, the then feelings of guilt and anxiety that then came with that. I think it was a real challenge to kind of accept it. It wasn't that I was kind of in denial because it all made sense, but I think I was more in denial about how could this be me? I'm a really strong, independent woman and, you know, how could I let this happen? And then I felt like I let my family down. You know, I come across as this really bubbly, ambitious, you know, 20-year-old, 21-year-old. And yeah, I just traveled the world and I had achieved so much that then I felt like a failure for being having this diagnosis. And I think even now, like, it's still only a recent thing that I can kind of raise my hand and say, yeah, this is my diagnosis, this is me, and this has been part of me for such a long time that I can now talk about it. And because I don't think that, say, I was 21, that it is my fault. It's not your fault at all. It's one of those things. It's our biology, it's our chemistry, it's our social situations. You can't prevent it. It's just part of you. And now is when I'm kind of accepting this and not seeing it as a negative, but seeing what I can achieve from it. So doing things like this, being able to talk about it, I never would have even thought about doing this before. So that's something that I kind of want to keep going with, and just sharing the stories, because I think if it can make a difference to just one person, then great. One person just thinks, you know what, I'm actually just going to go and talk to my GP because I think something's just not right. Great. That's all I can hope for.
That's really brilliant. And I think that's such an important thing to talk about there. It's so universal with the experience of mental illness that you self-blame. Mm-hmm. And particularly if you're someone that prides yourself on your strength or your resilience, you can want to reject it because it's like, no, this is something wrong with me. Yep. This doesn't fit who I am. I'm, you know, strong. I'm independent. I don't need support.
Yep.
But actually, I think in many ways, the more I learn about it, the more I understand how much of a strength it is, that actually we're more resilient because we're overcoming these things.
Yep.
We're stronger because we feel able to seek support.
Yep.
Okay, so I think that's a nice place to kind of round up. We're sadly running out of time.
I know, sorry, that's my fault.
No, not at all. So could you talk us through a little bit about your blog then that you want to tell the listeners about?
Yeah, so I write at jeffersadventures.com, and it's a travel blog covering kind of all travel destinations that I've been to, advice that I've given to kind of friends and, you know, for destinations, but also really celebrating London as well. I'm born and bred here. I absolutely love London, and there's so much to do London, UK, before we even travel overseas. So kind of covers everything, just my ramblings really about stuff I like to do and not do. But yeah, you can check us out at jeffersadventures.com.
Great, and I'll put that link in the description as well. But it's just nice to see that's an example where you've taken what, you know, studying abroad was one of your toughest times, but it's not put you off travel. You've still prioritized that as something that matters to you and something that you deserve to do and treat yourself with.
Yeah, and I think the point of writing kind of the blog was just a constructive outlet for me to kind of share my experiences with others, mm-hmm. that travel isn't a right. Is a privilege, and it's something that we can all take for granted that we have the opportunities to do it, but doesn't mean you have to fly the whole way around the world. It can be just going to your local beach, you know, seeing what is in your community and just experiencing the culture around you. So I think that's kind of where I want to be, is just kind of showing the best of both worlds.
Brilliant. Great. All right, so we'll finish
up. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
No problem, thank you.
Our petition to get mental health education onto the curriculum for all schools is continuing to gather momentum, and the Department for Education has now put forward initial plans on how to make this happen. If this petition is something you'd like to learn more about and hopefully sign it and share it as well, you can find out more at bit.ly/mentalpetition. The link for that is also in the description. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.